that truck with all the people in it come past him and block him. And they literally unload the truck. Like, again, it's like something you see in a combat zone. They were literally toting shotguns and long guns, rifles, and handguns. All of them come out of the truck and get this guy out of the driver's seat of the car. And one of them literally had a 12 gauge, looked to be a 12 or a 20. I couldn't tell. It was a shotgun. Crammed that shotgun in that dude's mouth, basically, and was holding him at gunpoint, telling him he's going to kill him. Now,
hey everybody, welcome back to the Hayden Alabama Podcast. We're Southern Storytellers. I'm Philip.
I'm David.
I'm Robin.
And I'm Jimmy.
Today we're in a familiar spot, although we've never been right here for this spot. We've recorded at this cabin in Mississippi, just in the outside of Philadelphia, a couple of times, and the shows have always been memorable and enjoyable for our audience. So we came back over this morning to do that. And let me tell you what you can expect today. We're going to get into the world of DEA from a Mississippi standpoint. We've got some state trooper commentary here. And then also, we're coming up on 20 years of the horrible situation of Hurricane Katrina. And we've got four stories, at least, from on the ground right after Katrina that likely will surprise you. And we have a write-in story. And then, as always, we're going to brag on Jesus for a little while. But that's what we got lined up here today.
Got a good show today.
I think so. Robin, I mean, why not? Why don't you just take off with the first story?
All right. We're going to tell a story about a family heirloom of mine. My children love to eat pancakes. Most youngins do. And I got to where I'd cook them every Sunday morning. We'd have pancakes, homemade pancakes. I had one skillet I cooked them out of. It was a good black iron skillet. And it was seasoned good. I guess that's how you say it about these things. And one Sunday morning, not too long ago, I was cooking them for my grandchildren, you know, passing things down the line, you know. Family heirloom, just stuff means the world to you. And blessed pal, I walked by that skillet and out of habit, I took that skillet and threw it in the air. I was going to catch it when it flipped, but I missed it. Hit that cement floor and busted in 1,000 pieces. And I thought, you idiot. You dummy. Why did you do that? What was the upside? I mean, I'm with taking risks. But what would you get in return? That you caught a skillet? That was high risk, low reward behavior. And I have whooped my youngest way less than that.
You might have got whooped if the ones that gave that to you were still around.
Oh, yeah, they was already arguing about it. When Daddy dies, I'm going to get that skillet. They're already arguing about that.
Was this before or after you cooked?
This is after I cooked. I cook a pancake.
I'm not doubting you can cook a pancake. My question is, was the skillet hot? Was it?
Oh, no. It'd sit there and cool it off.
And you just grabbed it, was just going to do a flip and catch it on the handle.
Yeah, for some reason, I thought I had to prove to myself I could still do it.
You can give everybody a piece now, though.
That's a good point, David.
Yeah,
you divided it up easy. You just solved a family dilemma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you break that skillet?
Yes, I did.
You wheeled it back.
No, it's too many. Yeah. It would never be the same.
You going to do it again sometime?
Maybe.
Only Robin.
You worked for the Mississippi, State of Mississippi, Bureau of Narcotics.
Yes, sir.
And it's no secret at all. When you're in that kind of realm, there's stories there that are exciting, maybe not in the moment, but afterwards. And I've asked you to bring a couple of those to the storytelling today. So tell us a couple of those stories from your career.
Traveling on I-20 one day, coming home from the district office, which was in Meridian, Mississippi, traveling back to Morton. And it was late afternoon. We'd been over there working. We'd actually gone out the night before and worked all night and was coming in that day, going home to try to get some sleep, actually. Coming along between Morton and Forest on I-20, I was westbound. And over in the eastbound traffic, I see a vehicle over on the shoulder of the road with a hood up and there's smoke coming out from under the vehicle. I also, as I'm passing, I observe a female with a baby and another gentleman, or a gentleman with them. And so I almost kept going, but that side of you, the side that public service, I guess, or, you know, trying to be a helpful to somebody, I cut across the median and went back. And pulled up behind the vehicle. The girl's up there holding the baby in front of the car, and the gentleman walks back and meets with me. Complacency, you know, that's something that law enforcement hears about all the time. Dave, I know you heard this many, many times too. Complacency kills, and stress and tiredness and just being worn out. Sometimes you overlook things. And so I get out of the car, walk up to this gentleman, ask him if he needed help. Obviously did, hood's up and car smoking, but asked him if he knew what was wrong with the car. He said, I think it's overheated. I think maybe you need water and radiator, whatever. So I go up to the front of the car, radiator cap still on it. Of course, he starts tinkering with it. I told him, leave it alone, because it's, you know, it's popping off steam, and it was obviously under a lot of pressure. So I said, just leave that alone. I said, here's what I'll do. If you where you can, I said, I will take you. Well, he asked me, would I take him to one of the exits? I said, I'll take you up to the forest exit. And Brother Robin, you remember they had a Best Western there when you got off the interstate on the right. I said, they actually have a place or a fund set up there with the Best Western through some of our local churches who would provide like overnight stay. They sometimes would give that family a few dollars to get gas, whatever it may be, but they had a little account set up for that. So I said, maybe they'll be able to help you and get somebody headed your way, and I'll call anybody you want me to call to try to get them here, whatever. But you know, I was ready to get to the house, I'm not gonna lie, but I was just totally worn out. So I take them to the, well, first I put them in the truck with me. I put the female and the baby got in the front seat. They didn't have a car seat with them too, by the way, but I put them in the front seat of my car and strapped them in. And the gentleman gets in the seat directly behind me. And so we pull back out on the road, and we go up to the forest exit, get off, go to the Best Western. Let them out of the vehicle. You know, they told me thank you, whatever. We talked briefly just between us, about a four-mile drive. So we didn't have a, you know, long, in-depth conversation, but we chatted about various things. They said they were from Monroe, Louisiana. And so drop them off at the front door of the hotel, and I leave. Well, no sooner did I get on the road, you know, pull back out on 35 there in front of the hotel, and I hear on the police radio that there was a disturbance at the hotel from the local police department. They were dispatching their officers for a disturbance there. Well, I was thinking, well, I'm right here at it. Just let these people out of the car. I'll turn around and see what it is and see if I can, you know, offer them help as well. So I turn around and go back to the hotel, and as I pull up to the front door, I see the gentleman who I'd let out of my truck running away from the hotel, and which I thought was odd. But you know, again, I'm tired, I'm brain's probably not working at, you know, like it should at the moment. Well, I see the manager of the hotel holding the doors closed, and I could see on her face she was, you know, obviously scared, something had her upset. So I get out of the vehicle, and she slings the door open. She says, come in, you know, get in here. She pulls the door, like she's trying to keep somebody from coming back out. I said, what in the world? What's happening? What's wrong? Mm. And her name was Robin, too, by the way. Miss Robin looked at me and she said, you need to talk to this lady about what she just told me and about why he ran out of here. And so I pulled a lady off to the side. She's at that moment, she's crying, still holding the baby. She's got tears in her eyes. You know, she's all, you obviously been crying for a minute or so at least, because I mean, she's literally her shirt wet in tears. And I said, ma'am, what's going on? I said, I just let y'all out of my truck. And she said, I couldn't say anything while I was in the car with you because he told me if I opened my mouth, he would kill me, the baby, and you. And I said, well, what are you talking about? She said, he killed my mother in Monroe, Louisiana, kidnapped me and the baby, and were taking us to Georgia. You know, for a second, you go, that can't be. I mean, you mean I just had this guy sitting right here behind me in the seat, and he killed your mother and kidnapped you and your baby? She said, yes, sir. I said, why didn't you give me some kind of nod or something, you know, to get my attention? She said, because he told me when you pulled up, he would kill the baby, he'd kill me, and he'd kill you if I said anything. Meanwhile, the police department is rolling up. So I step back out the door and tell them, I said, hey, a guy just went that way. Allegedly now is a murder suspect. He was a murder suspect on what she said, you know. So they take off in that direction. A few minutes, they come driving by. I stayed there with the baby and her. And they come driving back up to the front door, had the guy in the back seat. Officer gets out and walks around to me and said, come look at this. I walk over, and on his front seat, he had a 9mm pistol that he had taken off the guy. The guy hid in some bushes down the street there, and somebody saw him go into that little area, and they were able to apprehend him. But he had the pistol in his clothing that he killed her mother with in Louisiana. So I pick up the phone, and I call West Monroe Police Department just to see if they'd had a murder the night before or anything yet reported. And they said, no, we didn't. We had anything at their residence that we know of, but we'll send somebody over to see if there's anything out of place or anything unusual at the house. So they send a couple officers over, and within about 45 minutes, I get a phone call back that there's a body in the kitchen.
Well, man.
This kid had literally murdered his girlfriend's mom, kidnapped her and the baby, and were taking them somewhere in Georgia. I'm not sure. I don't remember where they were going, but I ended up in like a week-long murder trial in Louisiana about a year later. Matter of fact, I snowed in while I was there. But anyway, that's probably the most memorable story that makes me talk to officers, especially young officers, about, you know, just paying attention to, you know, and it shows
Jimmy,
you too.
The Lord was with you.
The Lord was with them too for breaking down.
Yeah, no doubt.
Jimmy, tell me another one. I liked that. That was a good one.
Well, another one that comes to mind. We had a situation where a state trooper had knocked off a vehicle that had, I want to say initially it was a 45 pounds of marijuana type stop. And so the guy cooperated. And he made a phone call back to his supplier. We made it look like the package had successfully made it to where it was going. And I think we're in the flight path.
I think we are.
So we made it look like that was successful, his original delivery, but we had him call his source, which was in Texas. That source agreed to bring him another load of marijuana. So we were going to actually pay him when a guy, we were going to fake a payment. It wasn't actually a payment. What we did is we took a couple $100 bills, put it on, we took some typing paper and cut it the same size as money. And we had stacks of it about this tall, wrapped up with $100 bills on top and a couple on the bottom where if you tore the package, you could see, you know, the $100 bill. And so it sounded like a good idea, right? So we put this big plan together with us, Baton Rouge Police Department and the Louisiana State Police to go down to Louisiana for that guy to bring this load of drugs and accept, you know, take the money. So it all started off to be a meeting at a bowling alley. And we had an undercover agent and an informant, which was the person who was cooperating that we stopped. Or that the patrol stopped. So we had one of our undercover agents with him go meet these people at a bowling alley. Well, one thing that when you work in undercover is that you don't want to do is what we call trip.
Are we going to be able to do it out here?
Yeah, I just don't know why that plane is literally just flying around us.
We're at the Columbis Air Force Base.
We're right in that Navy jet flight pattern.
Yeah. It just seems like that he would be long gone by now, but he's like he's just flying in circles.
He is flying in circles.
One of them that used to fly for him, redheaded. He guessed how low he got down. I could see what color his hair was.
Rough.
Yeah, we outside today, if you're listening on the audio only. And I really thought this was a good idea, and it has been up until this point.
Well, we're getting entertained by the Navy.
You sure are. Man, they're out there. They're burning the fuel today. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
So while we got a little bit of jet free space here, back to the undercover agent and the informant, we're going to meet these violators, as we refer to them in reports, at the bowling alley in Baton Rouge. And I don't remember which one, but Baton Rouge is a big place. And I knew absolutely nothing about Baton Rouge, by the way. So one of the things that we teach our undercover people is don't trip. Don't get in the car with people and leave with them. Now, we all know eventually, occasionally, sometimes plans change, and I'm not telling anybody that's coming up working in the undercover world listening to this as my advice to do so, but there's been a couple times when I had to take a ride with people when I was working undercover. So, but you always tell them don't trip, don't leave, because you lose control. While at the bowling alley, we had all entrances covered. If it, something went south, we had everybody in that bowling alley. And so they meet up at the bowling alley, and the first thing the violator says is, come on and ride with me. Of course, we in the car, our undercover agent cannot hear us talking to him, by the way. We can hear him over various wires and things that we had going, transmitters. We hear him say they fishing to take a ride. Of course, I'm wanting to tell him, do not get in that car. Don't leave with him. We're in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We get in this traffic, you have absolutely no control of the situation. So the undercover agent comes out with the informant, and they get in the informant's car, which they'd already put the 45 pounds of marijuana in the trunk of the car, by the way, or whatever the weight was on that particular deal. And they drive to Florida Avenue in Baton Rouge. I don't know if you know much about Baton Rouge, but that's the busiest street in Baton Rouge. So surveillance was next to impossible. On this particular incident, we had, at that time, the National Guard had a counter-drug unit that also helped us with surveillance and you know, various things that they're allowed to do through the military. And they had taken a big van down. And whether or not their commander knew at the moment that they were actually in Baton Rouge or not is still yet to be told, I think. But anyway, they were trying to catch up to us leaving the bowling alley, you know, because we'd already left the undercover and the informant left. We trying to fight traffic to stay up with them to watch them. Well, the guard guys were trying to catch up to us, and they end up having a head-on collision right in the middle of the turn lane right there by Florida Avenue, totaled out a National Guard van. And but we were able to continue on our surveillance. They obviously were no longer in the surveillance detail. But we followed them to a Hudgy's. There was you remember those Hudgy's restaurants, kind of like Sonic, some, you know, but there was a Hudgy's there. And like I said, we were on Florida Avenue, and that's all we knew. All I could tell anybody else on our team is, hey, we on Florida Avenue. We didn't have the pin dropping and all that stuff like you got today. You know, it was all on me telling you where we are. And so they're trying to get up there to where we can see what's going on. Well, the bad guy wants the undercover agent to show him the money, which is also kind of another no-no sometimes, especially when you've gotten out of your safety zone, because a lot of times that's leading to a robbery. He wants to see the money, make sure you got it, and he ain't gonna stick a pistol in your ear or kill you and take the money and the dope and go. So we hear him talking in the car. We hear him tell the undercover agent showing the money. Of course, we had it in a big brown bag, paper bag, had it bundled up. Well, the guy, thinking he's just gonna look at it and close the bag back up, pulls the bundles out of the bag, cuts one of them open, and immediately sees that it's, you know,
typing paper
with a couple hundred dollars on it. So now he draws a gun. So now you have in the car an undercover agent. And matter of fact, the informant, I told this a little bit wrong, the informant was still at the bowling alley. They were going to come back and get him. So now you just have an undercover agent and a bad guy in the informant's car. At the Hudgy's, the bad guy's got a gun, so our agent was able to grab a hold of him. At this point, it's go, go, go for us. We're coming in now, because, I mean, we think, you know, we got a problem. You know, Houston, we got a problem. Here it is. We got an agent in a car, bad guy with a gun. They're in a physical fight, we could tell from just hearing all the struggling. And so we start trying to get across Florida Avenue to Hudgy's, which was almost impossible. Luckily, there was an air conditioned man, a guy who owned an air conditioned company, was there eating, and sees all this. And he sees the door fly open on the car, and the guy, our agent, managed to fall out of the car, you know, to get it. He was trying to get away from that gun because he couldn't get control of the gun. So he opens the door somehow and comes out of the car backwards on his back, where the guy jumps in the driver's seat and takes off. Well, there was a air conditioned worker or air conditioned company owner there that sees all this, and he knows something ain't right. I mean, he sees a couple sets of blue lights coming in hot, so he manages to stay on the car. He actually took in behind him and gets 911 on the phone. And so, you know, we're going through all this traffic, trying to fight our way through it, and that guy you would think was familiar with Baton Rouge, although he wasn't, being from Houston. He was just lucky. He was getting through traffic a lot better than us. But the air conditioning guy was staying right behind him. I mean, this is crazy. I mean, it almost sounds unbelievable that a guy would put himself at risk like this after seeing what he just saw. But he stays on his car and followed him into an apartment complex and guided Baton Rouge police officers, like their uniform division, you know, who are on radios communicating back and forth traffic stuff. They converge on him, and we were able to catch the guy there in the apartment complex. But again, it just shows you how quick things can turn. You know, we were a little uncomfortable with being Baton Rouge because we didn't know the layout. And then you tell your undercover agent to don't trip, and he trips. I mean, you know, I'm not knocking him. He did a good job as it all worked out. But it almost got real bad. And so those type stories that, you know, we dealt with on not necessarily a daily basis, but you were up and down. You know, you'd have days when there wasn't a whole lot happening, and you'd have days that were just nonstop.
Are you in trouble? Well, we hope you're not. But just in case you are, we know a good lawyer. Whitney Island here in Hayden, Alabama has law services. Or maybe if you're not from Hayden, I'm sure she'd be happy to hear from you. So check her out at islandlaw.com. We appreciate Whitney and her sponsoring the show.
It was on a normal Thursday. I got on about what I got on now. I'm in Byron, Mississippi at our headquarters, and we get a call from one of our specialized units that said they were fixing to tail a vehicle from Jackson to Houston who was going to pick up about, if I remember right, he was going to pick up 10 kilos of cocaine.
Mm.
And so we were going to follow him down to Houston and then turn. It was supposed to be a turnaround trip, according to the information. It was just the guy was going to run down, pick it up, turn around, come right back to Jackson to drop it off. And then we were going to take out the house in Houston, and then we were going to take out the receiver in Jackson. So I pulled together as many people as I could right quick to get us a surveillance team to follow. Of course, most of us get cars were on quarter tanks and half tanks. And so anyway, we take off from Byram on surveillance, following this guy down I-55 to 10 and then across to Houston. And this guy never, on the days you expect to see a trooper, you don't. And the days you not expect to see, you see 10, right? Well, I figured sooner or later he's going to get pulled over and at least slow him down long enough for some of us to get gas, do something. But this guy never got under 100 miles an hour all the way to Louisiana. And when he got past Baton Rouge, I don't think we ever got under 105 all the way to Texas. So it was difficult running surveillance because if you stay on somebody that fast at that speed too long, they're going to pick up on you.
Absolutely.
So call them various things. We kind of the common term was leapfrogging. We change positions. You know, we'd have another vehicle come up and take over and one fall back, maybe stop and get gas and then try to catch up. But the problem catching up was they're doing 100. So you really couldn't be on the throttle. So this goes on all the way to Houston. We get to Houston. We roll into a neighborhood over there. He goes to a house, and we took up surveillance positions around the neighborhood best we could. Again, we don't know Houston, so we don't know who's bad, who's good, so we're having to find kind of public places to maybe pull in and park. So me and one of my agents at the time that worked under my supervision in that particular office happened to be in the same vehicle. And we pulled into a city park, and we quickly learned through some of our intelligence people, I can't really give up exactly how we knew, but we knew that there was going to be a delay in him leaving with the drugs. It was the load had been held up actually at the border. It was coming straight in from the border. So we didn't know how long it was going to be held up. 1 day, 2 days, 2 hours, 3 hours, what? We didn't know that yet. It ended up being a 3-day trip, by the way. But anyway, as we're sitting, now, also you got a picture of us now. We got on the same clothes we had on the day before yesterday. And this is on the third day. We're sitting in a little city park there, about to go stir crazy. We'd rotate positions, but you're just getting totally bored and worn out from not being able to sleep. You know, one sleep in the car, the other one stays awake in case something happens. And then, you know, it's just constant surveillance for almost pushing 40 hours. But we're sitting in this little city park. It was just getting dark, and we see a little truck coming down the street with about 15 people in the back of it. I mean, literally, it looked like a scene out of Somalia. Because they were hanging out of the truck, literally, with long guns. It's like, is this a hallucination? Or what am I seeing here? Well, there's a little car right in front of them, and there's speed bumps. That street that went to the house had these built-in street speed bumps. So they're coming over speed bumps a little fast, not at high speed, but, you know, a little quick. So I'm sensing something going on between these two vehicles. Well, you would know. That vehicle turns in our parking lot, comes around, and parks kind of like this behind my truck. So I'm looking at him. If I'm facing this way, I'm looking at him at about this angle. He stops. That truck with all the people in it come past him and block him. And they literally unload the truck. Like, again, it's like something you see in a combat zone. They were literally toting shotguns and long guns, rifles, and handguns. All of them come out of the truck and get this guy out of the driver's seat of the car. And one of them literally had a 12-gauge, looked to be a 12 or a 20. I couldn't tell. It was a shotgun. Crammed that shotgun in that dude's mouth, basically, and was holding him at gunpoint, telling him he's going to kill him. Now, keep in mind, we're in Houston, Texas. We don't really have any jurisdiction as far as, you know, technically arresting powers or anything like that. But number one, what are you going to do here? Because I'm sitting on a 9mm. My rifle is under the seat in a container, you know, in the back. My partner, Shane, 9mm, was stuck on the seat, and all he had was his little snub-nose 38, his backup gun. And so we're sitting here going through the, what do you do? I mean, we didn't really have anybody to call other than by telephone or our radios, which wouldn't reach very far away from our repeater system. So we could only talk a certain distance. We only had one or two other units that we could even communicate with. So here we are, we're about eight guys with shotguns and rifles, and we're sitting here with a 38 and a 9mm already on the down, because they've already got the jump, basically. They already got guns at, you know, port arm, but they stand here holding guns, ready position. So we really in a position to do nothing unless we absolutely have to. In other words, if we really get to the point where we feel like he's fisting to pull the trigger and murder this guy right in front of us, obviously we got to try to do something. So your brain's spinning. What do you do? Well, I look up. Well, I'm looking out the window. I have my window about halfway down, and they're kind of dark tinted, so you really couldn't see much but about this much of me, you know, kind of looking out the window. And as I turned my head back, I was going to look over at Shane, see what he's doing. And when I turn around, there's a 38 right here. The cylinder's right here, his gun. I go, Shane, give me time to put my fingers in my ear for you.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I mean, the cylinder's right here, so you're going to get a good blast of the face. But I do remember asking, I said, Shane, what are you doing? He said, I'm finna let the air out of that guy. I said, man, do not pull that trigger unless we absolutely have to, because we're total bad outnumbered. I think training would have played in. We might have done okay there, but my gut was, we don't want to take on three long guns, four long guns with a pistol. You're just not going to probably win that fight in the end. So, I guess the good Lord intervened, and these guys let these two guys go, get back in their truck and leave. But that's just another one of those, like I said, day in the office type things when we weren't anticipating anything on a Thursday, and here we are on a Sunday still in Houston. Running surveillance and almost, you know, end up in a shootout, or witness a murder. So it just shows you how quick things change, how quick life changes, and how, you know, we're sitting there kind of bored to death, thinking, good Lord, let this guy get in the car and let's go back to Jackson. If he gets the dope or not, let's go. You know, you get to that point. And then it goes from being, totally exhausted to the adrenaline's out the roof.
I want to go back to Texas just a second. I want to go back to Houston. You set up a really intense situation there outside your window, and obviously right in front of your face as well. There's a lot going on right there. I want to finish that out. You're watching this almost maybe an execution right here in front of your face that's just happenstance. Mm-hmm. What did happen, though? The guy just took the gun down and decided not to smoke the guy right there?
It was like there was a signal thrown or something. And I don't know what made them all.
You think they may have saw y'all sitting
no,
there?
No, I don't think they ever paid us any attention. I'll be honest with you, that element of people that we were looking at there didn't look like the type that would have cared. and, you know, here's a sad thing. Is in a lot of our bigger cities, inner cities, it's not so bad here. We have our own problems here, we all know, and you're sure you do over in here in Alabama, wherever. But a lot of these inner cities are totally lost in some areas. I know that sounds almost unbelievable, but we had some cities close to home that bigger cities. I don't get in punch and call names right now, but one just right across Pearl River that for a while was lawless in areas.
Lawless.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I don't know who you point a finger at on that.
I do.
Let's not do it here. This is storytelling. This is not we're not taking positions politically.
Oh no, I wouldn't.
But in that realm of life or work, you encounter places like that are just, you know, you hate to say it like that, but there's
the Wild West.
It's worse.
You know, another place people really misbehave and you see the worst in humanity is when a natural disaster hits. And Katrina sure had her share of that. But I was down there. This was a few days afterwards. I was tree cutting and helping. And I went down there with a guy who had a big old walk-tall four-wheel drive. And we were right on 90 Highway. And I was working one day with a chainsaw, had sweat dripping off my nose, stinking, nasty, ill. I felt somebody touch me. I said, what? I turned around and there's this little old lady, sweet little old lady. She said, son, will you do me a favor? I said, ma'am, if I can, I will. She said, will you take me down to the graveyard and see if my husband's still there? I said, well, ma'am, they being real picky on how we travel and where we can go and all that. I said, but if you'll ride with me, she said, oh, I want to. I said, you'll tell them police that story you just told me? We ain't going to get stopped. So we got her in this big walk, tall, four-wheel drive, which was an episode. And she's about 90. And we headed down Highway 90. There were chunks of 90 Highway missing. Yeah. We ran into law enforcement agencies from 7 states. And I said, I'd let the wind down, I'd point to her, and she'd tell them, she said, go on. And we got there, and her husband was still there, but there's a bunch of them that wasn't.
Mm.
And excuse me. People just want closure, and people just were in a bind.
That was the most important thing to her down there at that moment.
Yeah.
There was an ice plant about 4 or 5 blocks deep into Gulfport, just right in kind of the downtown area, but it was like an ice plant. You could go and buy it. It's where they filled up these big ice trucks, you know. So we were doing grid searches. We were searching building to building, house to house, and we get to this ice plant, and it looked as if somebody may have already checked it out because there was some netting up by the door, like that orange netting like you see along the highway, safety net, erosion type stuff. So there was some of that across the door, but I could hear something barking, sound like a dog.
Like a red bone?
Yeah, not quite. He didn't have no hideout. He didn't do none of that. But I could hear what I thought was a dog. So I climbed over the net and thinking maybe it was a puppy or something trapped in the building, and we get him and take him to one of the shelters or get somebody to come get him. I go over the net and walk through the little big room here, and there's a hall turned to the right. As I turn the hall, I'm looking at a darn sea lion. And I mean, looking at him, we like almost eyeball to eyeball.
They bigger than folks think.
Thing was huge. And he starts going, oh, oh, and running. Well, I don't know if that's a mean bark or I'm glad to see you bark, right?
But you had experience with that goat that time, so you should have been ready to go.
I had experience, too, in running. And I hurdled that net that was across the thing. I actually got some pictures of him in a little book I put together on Katrina, but that was a crazy experience. You talk about, you know, just outside of the death and destruction, I mean, there were some other things that were kind of humorous and fun to do.
Well, you had to find something to relieve you.
Oh, yes, sir.
To just get through it because it was so bad.
Well, I did a podcast a few days ago about Katrina. It was about an hour and 20, 30 minutes long from front to back, from deployment to the end of it. And, another example of, you know, alligators were everywhere. I cannot tell you how many alligators that we caught and moved, big ones, and I'm not talking about little ones. So we just kicked them out of the way, but we had 10, 11, 12 footers that we had to move. Game and fish was overwhelmed with what they were having to do, so we just had to get them out of the way. And a bunch of dead ones that drowned. I mean, who thinks an alligator drowned? But they did in Katrina. Saw it with my own eyes. There were dead alligators everywhere. Snakes, everywhere. But the craziest thing I saw dealing with an animal while we were there. We see something on the roof of a house that looked odd, and the house had not been searched yet. It had sandbags on the outside. We marked those houses. You remember the X's and all? We would mark them as we searched them, and that indicated several things. When it was searched, if anybody's found in it, dead or alive, and your badge number and something else. I don't remember what the other little pot was. But anyway, we knew that house hadn't been searched yet, or if it hadn't been marked. But we see something on the roof thinking, what is that? Because it looked like horns, like a set of horns. I get up a little closer, and there's a bull. His head was above the roof line. When he went through the roof, his horns caught him, you know, like hanging. So we go into the house, and the rest of the bull is hanging down into the living room or one of the rooms. You really couldn't tell what the living room, because there's no sheetrock, because when the water got up, all the sheetrock melted and fell off the wall. So all the houses in there were just studs when you went in them. That was confusing to me at first till I realized the water did it. You know, how did the wind blow the sheetrock off the wall? Well, it didn't. It was water that made it dissolve. But anyway, here's about an 1,800-pound bull hanging through a roof. And the only explanation I can give you is the water line there got to the roof on those houses. I feel like this poor bull was swimming, and that's the first thing he could get on. He gets on the house. When the water goes down, the weight of the bull probably just dropped. You know, he probably just broke through the that's the only reasonable explanation I got. But it was just
that's crazy.
There's a lot of unexplainable stuff down there.
We could talk for 2 days.
And he had been dead for a little while
when y'all found him. At that point, probably 2 to 3 days. And you already know. The sad part is not only animals were found like that.
Oh, yeah.
You
know? That's awful.
And you never – that's something I think that thing changed people for forever. I know it did me. It changed my perspective on a lot of stuff.
I don't think all those big alligators drowned. If you know what I mean.
Well, some of them may have got shot.
Shot. There's a rumor.
Well, I'm here to tell you, if it comes, that's I was in the fear of my life.
we ain't had no problem. Well, we would take a t-shirt or something, throw over the head and slip a rope over the head and drag them. We just pull them. They steady trying to get away from you.
Really?
Yeah, it's like pulling a grizzly bear, though. I mean, they lock in.
Had a parking brake on.
We hit a couple to the ball hits and drug them about 20 yards. That's slow speed. We didn't want to hurt, you know, because enough of them died. But there was a bunch more left.
Man, you told me several things that I did not know, and I was alive during that mess. And that's good insight. Robin, you said you had one more from down there, though.
Yeah, I was in the steep.
This
greenhouse. It's a real steep roof greenhouse that somehow, some way didn't blow down. It's right there on 90 Highway. I told my partner that. I said, look, I'm going to hang over the side of this thing. I'm going to see about getting this gutter off. And I tied my rope to a clothesline post. I left a big old tag down. All you had to do, it's called a shepherd's knot, and you just pull that tag and your rope comes undone. I'm hanging over a house. I'm down low, thank the Lord. And another old lady walked out, and she said, hey, what's this rope? And pulled it, untied me. My booty went in a flower pot.
Oh,
I had the worst bruise I ever had on my hip.
Rob, you have some of the worst luck.
He brings it on himself.
Well, I wasn't going to say that.
He brings it on himself.
You could make your own hypothesis, though. Is it Robin's fault or somebody else's?
A lot of self-inflicted injuries here.
Yeah.
Robin hit on something that stands out, too, I think is interesting for you. Because I know we're all Christians sitting here and all have our own ideas and things about a lot of stuff in life. But one of the things that stands out to me that I really do remember, and I think I'll go to my grave remembering this, is all the destruction down there. Guess what? In most areas, was still standing.
Steeples.
Everywhere you went. Wow. Now, not to say they wasn't tore up the building, you know, the water damage, what have you. But something that really, really resonated with me is crosses. There was one instance where a Bible was found that was literally solid Bible, undamaged.
Pristine condition.
I can't explain that because it was water 18 feet deep in those areas. So how did it manage to be one of the only items that was almost untouched? Now, we can all speculate and say what you want to say, and you know, but I know what I think.
I know
what
I believe.
You know what you saw is what you're saying.
I know what I saw, yes.
Something to that.
But that really, really resonated with me is we talked about that. When we were riding along those areas doing our surveys and doing searches, is, you notice anything here, Wesley, or you notice anything here, Ben? And they're like, I'm like, look at that cross. Still standing there. Mm. Almost like it, in most cases, like it was untouched. That's now, the crazy buildings around it were.
If you went just in a helicopter, I went up in a helicopter from one side of the state to the other, and you wouldn't believe the steeples that were left. It was one after another all down the coast. Really neat to see.
And there was nothing else. That's what's crazy.
Just steeples.
If you look at helicopter footage from that thing, and fortunately, you know, I got to fly in helicopters down there for a couple of weeks, searching islands to do whatever was going on at that moment. But as far inland as you could see, the naked eye was just gone. And like he said, they were a little same white cross sticking
out. Mm. Yep. Praise the Lord.
Amen. We got a couple more things we want to accomplish, though. Mr. Davis got a story. I've got a write-in story from one of our fans that I really liked, and I'm going to share. We've got a little information of some way that you may be able to help, and then we got scripture time. But, David, I want you to lead us off into this fourth quarter here.
Fourth quarter. When I was coming up, I used to hunt at a High Point Hunting Club. I was a guest all the time, tight-knit bunch of guys. We were all friends. Then I left Louisville, moved away for 17 years, worked for the Highway Patrol in South Mississippi and college and whatnot. When I came back, I reconnected with one of my old hunting buddies, David Taylor, called him Sarge, great guy. He had always hunted with us. He took a little year or two off one time and vacationed in Vietnam back in the 70s, another story. But when I came back, David had a small engine shop. And so my boys grew up, my two kids, us going to Sarge's other side of the county, taking the four-wheeler and lawnmower, you know, and grew up in Sarge. Eventually went to work for the Department of Corrections, and I worked in another town, worked in Kosciuszko. And so I really lost contact with most everything in Louisville. I was working, leave at dark, get back at dark a lot of times. And I had a good lawnmower then, too, so I didn't need to see old David as much. And so I'm coming back from circuit court one day, and the guy that's driving the car, he's in the VFW with Sarge. I knew that. And I said, we passed the appropriate road, and I said, I need to take my lawnmower for something to see Sarge. And he's hesitating. He said, Sarge? And I said, yeah. He said, David, he said, we buried Sarge 2 weeks ago. And I thought, dang, man, you know? You know somebody that many years, and all of a sudden you don't even get any closure, you know, but there's nothing you can do. You just got to move on. So a year or two later, I retire last time. Hadn't thought much about pool Sarge. I go in Western Auto, and there's Odie Keene works there, and Odie and I got to talking, and Odie had a new old four-wheeler he'd bought, and he said, I need to have it worked on. I think I'll take it to Sarge. And I said, Sarge Taylor? He said, yeah. I said, man, I hate to break the news to you. I said, you ought not be laughing. I said, Sarge been dead 2 years. He said, no, he's camping out and crappie fishing at Neshoba Lake. He's not dead. And I thought, he's not. He said, yeah, he's bad sick, but he never died. And I thought, so that was Friday. So Monday morning at 8 o'clock, I'm at Sarge's Small Engines. There that dude is alive.
Resurrected.
And I took a picture of him, sent it to my boys. I said, Sarge is alive. And I told him the story. I said, Sarge, I'm sorry. I haven't been here in 2 years. I didn't know how bad sick you were. I thought you were dead. And I didn't need counseling. I mean, I didn't break down and cry, but I have missed you. He said, he's been working on your four-wheeler. I told him, he said, man, he's working on your four-wheeler. I said, yes, Sarge, you were dead.
I
had to move on to another
guy. Yeah, somebody to fix
it. That's get right. Somebody to do it.
Well, I'm going to give you a write-in story. The best recounting of a written story that was written to the Hayden Outbound podcast was emailed. I'm not going to name drop because I don't know if they would like to have their name shared or not. But this man and one of his best friends were coming up and through the ranks of being preachers. And as Robin has testified, sometimes when you're getting your start in preaching, you find areas where you don't, or you're not able to do a lot of damage. Isn't that how you say that, Robin? Well, one of those areas can be, and not that it's any less important, but it can be, and that's a nursing home. You know, nursing homes are looking for people to come in, spend time with them, speak. So they had this nursing home that they were going and preaching at every week. And they would go and preach at the nursing home. And he said there'd be 10 or 15 people there in the room. And they would preach, not get a lot of response, as you can imagine. And they would leave and they would talk about their sermons and what they need to do different to really get that. And his buddy got to praying for a revival. He wanted the revival fire to come down on this nursing home. And they were supposed to meet there the next time. He'd been praying for this. And something run him late. And so he ended up preaching a little bit later than he normally would. But he got in there. He was a little disheveled. He put himself together, got the little pulpit, drew it out there. And there was the usual 10 or 15 people, congregants in the nursing home waiting for him. He got to preaching. And he got excited. He said this is the message that they needed, and he was just laying it down. He was up there chopping wood. And all of a sudden, he started noticing, well, there's another one and another one. Then here come another one on a little rascal, and then here come another one on a walker. And then 5-10 minutes later, he started seeing the workers come in the room. And before, he's 3/4 of the way through his sermon, and he has a room full of people. And in his mind, he's thinking, God has heard my prayer. Revival is falling in the nursing home here. And about that time, he notices a lady starts in the back. She's one of the workers there, and she's kind of making her way through the crowd that's formed there in the hall. And she comes up to him right in the middle of his sermon, or 3/4 of the way through his sermon. And he's thinking, man, she must have something really important. Like, she is coming down to maybe wants to pray. She's coming to the altar. And very politely, she goes up to him, and she just whispers in his ear, how much longer are you going to be preaching? Not the response that he thought he was going to have. He said he just caught him off guard. Why would she be wondering if this fire and brimstone sermon is going to be wrapped up? The Spirit's moving. And he said, well, I'm probably 3/4 of the way finished. Why? And she said, well, it's 15 minutes past lunch. Instead of the revival falling, his late arrival to the nursing home had put him into the lunch hour. And so all the people had come expecting lunch and were patiently waiting for him to finish his fire and brimstone so that they could enjoy their lunch at the nursing home.
He was finished, wasn't he?
He was.
That was the last day that he preached at the nursing home.
He was standing between them and some fried chicken.
That's exactly what he is doing. But, you know, I love their heart, love the heart of the story. Two preachers trying to get their start and doing the best they can. Just got to know your audience and know what time it is, I think. Robin, you ever preach too long? You ever go into the lunch hour?
I have. I remember as a little boy sitting there saying, when is this guy going to shut up? So I'm probably too conscious about time. I don't preach very long.
I got you. Thank you for writing in. And if you have a story for the Hayden Alabama podcast that you'd like for us to share on the show, you can write us at admin@HaydenAlabamaPodcast.com. Write out the story and we'll do our best to share it on the show one day. It really is a blessing. Well, Mr. Jimmy, tell us a little bit about your organization real quick and how people can do their part in helping some kids out.
Well, me and 3 more guys have a little group called Grab You One Outfitters. It's GrabYouOne. So it's Grab You One Outfitters. And Grab You One started as a hobby, started as a fishing trip, turned into a snake grabbing trip. Yeah, it's snake grabbing. And that eventually turned into a television show on CMT and Amazon. And then we figured out a way to turn it into a benefit. So what we did, the benefit started is during the TV show, we decided that we would tie 10% of whatever we made from the show to a charity. And we did it to several locations. I don't know if they want it thrown out, some of them in public. But long story short, we then decided let's look at a way to target a certain child. Because not to say that giving to a hospital is not a good thing, but we wanted to see a particular family or, a particular child maybe that's in a special need to be able to help them. So over the past few years, at least in the last 3 years, it's grown to the point where just in the last 3 seasons, we've given away over $250,000 just to three different kids. And it's 100% of the donations go to the children. It's a true nonprofit, although we're not labeled as nonprofit. We run it through a 501, which is. And the reason we hadn't done that is because we all got full-time jobs and just it's a hobby. It's not. Yeah. If it becomes my retirement thing to do when I retire, we may convert it into a 501 ourselves, but we have a 501 we partnered with. So if you contribute to it or make any type of donation to it, you can do it through the 501 and you also get a tax break. And the child gets 100% of the, it's not one of these that goes and 15% goes here and 20% yeah. goes there. And it's whatever we deposit into that account or you deposit in that account, then is at the end of it, at the end of the time frame, that check is written in that amount to the child. We just set up one trust the other day for $105,000 for a kid, and we'd already given a check to a investment account for another kid from this season.
That's awesome. So
it was a total of $210,000 just this season alone. Man, so
that's significant.
It's Mississippi, man. Look, and Alabama, we're all a lot alike.
You have an event every year.
Every year we do a snake grabbing rodeo at Lake Washington.
I get it. I'm like, what are they doing? This is crazy.
We take five teams, and it's kind of like a bass fishing tournament. The teams
kind of like.
In fact, Brother Robin's been to it.
Oh, yeah.
The five teams go their different directions. They catch as many snakes as they can catch. When they come back to the pier, we do a count. Mm-mm. We do a weigh-in account, and we do a measurement on the largest snake. Obviously, you'll be able to tell which two or three is going to be measured, but we do trophies for the first, second, and third place teams, and we do a trophy for the largest snake. And then at that point, we do the check presentations to the children. And we also, this year, we had four bands playing at that event. So, I mean, it's turned into what used to be a 100 people maybe at an event. It's now 1,000 people at the event.
And it's held when? Usually about what time?
Always the first weekend in June.
Always the first weekend
in June. At Roy's Store in Lake Washington at Chatham, Mississippi.
Well, what we're going to do for you guys, if this is something that's interesting to you, we're going to link where you can watch some of the videos. They have videos that you can watch. We'll also link a website so that if you would like to donate for this cause, that you could do that. And we just appreciate your heart for the kids, heart for the families that are going through some times that nobody could foresee, nor would they elect to go into. And you're making it a little bit easier for them. We appreciate that.
Well, we thank you for mentioning it.
Let's have our scripture time and brag on Jesus a little bit. Today, we are in John chapter 13. And I'm not going to read 1 through 17, but I encourage you, if you would like to go back and get every word of this, open your Bible to John chapter 13. It's 1 through 17, what I'm going to cover. But this is where Jesus washes the feet of his disciples. That's a good call, David. That was good. That's why you're looking at me weird.
Now thought I was winking at you or something.
Let's read, but I am going to read a little bit of it. Starting at the first verse, before the Passover celebration, Jesus knew that his hour had come to leave this world and return to his Father. He had loved his disciples during his ministry on earth, and now he loved them to the very end. It was time for supper, and the devil had already prompted Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had given him all authority over everything, and that he had come from God and would return to God. So he got up from the table, took off his robe, wrapped a towel around his waist, and poured water into the basin. Then he began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that he had around him. That's a couple of things there that we got to just know. Jesus had all the power and all the authority.
All of it.
Completely sovereign, could have done anything that he wanted to do, yet humbled himself, took a knee, and then took the feet of 12 disciples, one that was fixing to betray him to the Roman government for death, and another one that was fixing to deny him three times that he even knew him. And not only were the feet dirty, but those are whose feet Jesus washed. The ultimate thing that I want people to see here is if we call ourselves Christians, which should mean that we believe and have faith and have confessed Jesus Christ as Lord, if that's true, and we call ourselves Christians, then the next thing is Jesus called us to be followers of him. If we're going to say that we follow Jesus, then we're going to have to be servants at the lowest level. when I went back and looked at the history of this passage, Jewish people would not even ask other Jewish people, or even the servants, they would not ask them to wash their feet. The only people that they would allow to wash their feet were slaves and Gentiles. And yet Jesus, Son of God, God in flesh, does the lowest of the low service for people that absolutely did not deserve it. If we're Christians, we're called to be servants. I'm not being legalistic and saying, well, if you're not doing that or not doing that, that's not what I'm talking about. But if we are going to follow Him as He has called us to follow Him, then we're going to have to serve other people and not consider things to be beneath us, because Jesus went to the lowest level and served right there. And I have an opportunity to do better, amen?
We all do.
We all have an opportunity to do better. So there's the fact of the matter. I just want, if you weren't aware of the level of Jesus' servitude, even with all power and authority, I want you to be aware of that. But then let's go down to verse 17. I'm going to skip some verses. These are words in red. This is what Jesus said there at the end. Now that you know these things, that you ought to serve and wash each other's feet, God will bless you for doing them. But don't, let's go, let's tune in. Know is one part. It's a two-part thing. Know and do.
You know, Philip, a lot of people I come in contact with say, that's just not me. That's just not who I am.
I understand.
Well, I tell you what, you give your life to Jesus, that's who you will become.
That's who you're called to be.
Because He made the decision to do that. We got to follow His decision.
That's right. And then I'm not saying that I'm not a prosperity gospel preacher or name it and claim it. That's not me. I don't see that in the Bible. But what we do have to hold on to here, this is a promise of Jesus, that if you know and do these things, if you know that you're supposed to serve and you serve other people like Jesus did, you will be blessed for doing them. So Jesus promises a blessing for us. I'm not saying that we should be motivated, but I'm going to serve because Jesus promised He's going to bless us. That's not what I'm saying. But God is good and faithful to give us blessings that will absolutely be a blessing with no remorse if we're willing to serve other people to the level that He did.
Don't do it because you have to. Do it because you want to.
Yep. Amen. And you can have a hope and a motivation of a true blessing from God by being obedient and doing those things. Can you put an amen on that, or we got something else we want to share about?
No, that's
That's good. Well, let me give you a challenge before we end the scripture time. I want to give you, each and every person that's watching, is a challenge. If you've never done it, or if you do it all the time, sometime this next week, before next Tuesday, I want you to look for an opportunity to serve somebody in a way that you would have previously overlooked or said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I just want you to say, nope, this time I am going to do it. And I just want you to see what happens and see if God won't bless you. If you do it out of love and for the right reasons, see if God won't bless you for performing an act of service just like Jesus has performed for us. That's going to do it today at the Hayden Outbound Podcast. I'm Philip.
I'm David.
I'm Robin.
And I'm Jimmy.
We'll see you guys.
Like, share, and subscribe.
So like, share, and subscribe, and we'll see you guys next week.